Okay, the most popular Rashi on Parshas Vayeshev, without a doubt, is on the pasuk of Vahabar Reikim B'Mayim. The Torah tells the story about how the brothers were going to kill Yosef. Then Reuven came along and said, "No, don't kill him. Just throw him into the bar." And the pasuk says, "Vahabar Reikim B'Mayim." And Rashi brings down the Medrash. The very dramatic medrash, mayim ein bar, the pasuk says that it was empty. The says throw him into the pit was empty. Ein mayim, there's no water. And Rashi says, mayim ein bar, avon nechashim akrabim yesh bar, that it wasn't as empty as you think. There was taka no water, but there were snakes and scorpions in the pit. Now, why is this the most popular Rashi in Parshas Vayeshev? Because Parshas Vayeshev, of course, always falls down in close proximity to Hanukkah. And this Medrash that Rashi quotes is a Gemara, Shabbos Daf Chaf Beis, Darash Amrav Kahana, Darash Rav Nosson Bar Menyumi, Mishmeid Rav Tancham, Bar Reikim B'Mayim, Mayim Ein Bar, Melechoshem Bar Kavim Yeshbay. Now Shabbos Daf Chaf Beis is right in the middle of the Chanukah Sugya. It starts on Daf Chaf Aleph, it goes through Daf Chaf Gimel. The Gemara immediately before is about an Ner Chanukah that's placed on Ma'al Me'asim Amma. The Gemara immediately after is about counting your money by the light of the Ner Chanukah. Before that, maybe is about putting it on the left side of the doorway. Al Kapanim, it's all Hilchas Chanukah over there, and smack in the middle is this medrash that Mayim Ein Bar Al Nechashim Akrab Yesh Bar. So Darshanim like to talk about what the Shaychus is to Chanukah. Now, for the sake of full disclosure, it should be noted that there doesn't really have to be a connection to Chanukah because if you're familiar a little bit with the way Talmud Bavli works. The Gemara had just brought a different Amar of Kahana, Darash of Nasim Amanyumi, Mishmei Darav Tanchom, about Ner Chanukah Shnichlam Al Me'asim Amma. And then it's the Derech HaTalmud that then they go from one statement to the next that was by the same author. So this is another Amar of Kahana, Darash of Nasim Amanyumi, Mishmei Darav Tanchom. So this gets brought in, and it could be that it's brought in without any Sheikhs. But that being said, Darshanim do love to find a Kesher that it has with Chanukah, because it comes in the middle of the Chanukah sugya. And the Meshech Chachma has something a little bit kedarka, a little bit more elaborate, than a little more developed than some of the others. The Meshech Chachma says that this same, the author of this medrash, right, in the Gemara, it's said over in the name of Rav Tanchum. Now, Rav Tanchum, who appears in the Talmud Bavli, he also appears often in the Medrash, and over there he's called Rav Tanchuma. There's a whole Medrash called Medrash Tanchuma, which is from Rav Tanchuma, Rav Tanchum, and he's also sometimes quoted in the Medrash Rabbah as Rav Tanchuma. Now there's a Rav Tanchuma that appears in Bereshis Rabbah, in Parshas Vayechi, as follows. The Pasuk is talking about how they made a funeral for Yaakov, they brought him to Eretz Yisrael, they buried him in Eretz Yisrael, and then they're going back down to Mitzrayim. And it says that Yosef went a little bit out of his way when they were returning to Mitzrayim, and Yosef went to visit the bar that he had been thrown into so many years previously. And it says he went, he was Heitzitz Babar, he looked into the bar.
That's a medrash.
That's a medrash. That's Rav Tanchum in the medrash says that Yosef went and he was Heitzitz Babar. And then he adds the words, L'shem Shemayim Niskaven, meaning, because this gesture was really misinterpreted. The brothers saw him going and looking in the bar. They thought that he meant to be reopening old wounds. That's why, if you may remember, at the very end of Parshas Vayechi, it says that the brothers were all worried, Lu Yistameinu Yosef, Yosef is going to hate us, and then they made a whole delegation to go and approach him and beg him for mercy and for forgiveness. And Jesus says, no, I don't really have any tainas, any arguments against you. What triggered them to say, Lui Yistameinu Yosef? It's because they saw him going back to the bar as if to say, this is what they did to me. But Rav Tanchuma in the Medrash says, Yosef went, he was Heitzitz Babar, U'L'Shem Shemayim Niskaven. But he only meant it for the best. He only meant L'Shem Shemayim. Because he wanted to see where the nace happened. He wanted to be reminded of his nace. That's why he did it. They misunderstood, but he was really doing it on the Shem Shemayim. So that's Shechachma. Goes into a little bit of a halacha discussion. There's a Mishnah in Brachas, the ninth paragraph, talks about the unusual brachas that we make occasionally. So it talks about a bracha that you make, b'makom shenasa leneis. If somebody had a neis hap, b'makom shenasa leneis, he makes a bracha. The Rishonim clarify that this bracha on a makom shenasa leneis is only if something happened that was yotzei chutz leteva. It had to be something really supernatural. There are lots of things that we call neis. You know, a person, Rachmana Litzlan, he gets into his car skids, he crashes, or he almost crashes, and he escapes, you know, unharmed. You know, that kind of thing you might talk about Shgoimel for, because you were definitely in a place of sakana, but there wasn't anything overtly supernatural. If a person, you know, people do sometimes not get injured in car accidents. The bracha of Makom Shenasa Leneis is only if something overtly supernatural happens, something that can't be explained al derech
hateva. Why don't we make it on Pesach?
We make a bracha of Asher Gal, right? We make a bracha of Asher Gal and Gal Yisrael. But this is really about a private Makom Shenasa Leneis is for a private. Right. It's also made for if a person comes to the place of Kriyas Yamsuf. Make a bracha for that also.
Yitz says ultra natural nisim happened to him all the time.
Every day.
Has anybody ever made this bracha? I know, it's a good question.
I've never made it.
No, I've never heard
of
it. It's also yes,
in
the room.
Yeah.
For any ancestors, yeah.
Not me.
Right? So you see like a place where your grandfather thought had an ace.
I think so, yeah.
So, we say it is by Hanukkah.
It's only for seeing the place.
You're saying an actual.
You have to come to the place. If you come personal. To the place, right? The Gemara gives some. I think. The examples that the Gemara gives is if you come to the site of Kriyas Yamsuf, if you come to the site of where Moshe Rabbeinu was holding his hands up by Melchemes Amalek, those are some of the examples in the Gemara. So. The Meshech Chochma says that when Rav Tanchum in the Medrash tells us that Yosef went and he looked into the bar, Ulshim Shemayim Niskaven, what it means is this, that Yosef had definitely had an extraordinary roller coaster ride. He was despised by his brothers. They took him, they tried to kill him. He didn't die. They took him, they threw him into slavery. They sold him into slavery. From slavery, where it looked like things could hardly get worse, it got worse. He then wound up in jail. And then after jail, he then wound up in the king's palace as the Mishnah Melech, through which he ended up being in a position to save the whole world, or much of the world, from the hunger. He was in a position to orchestrate the fulfillment of the dreams of having the brothers come. There was extraordinary Hashgacha Pratis, extraordinary Yad Hashem. But there's a bracha, and you don't make the bracha for Hashgacha Pratis. You don't make the bracha for recognizing the Yad Hashem, right? The Poskim say the bracha is only if there was an overtly supernatural event. Now, getting called out of jail, you know, getting thrown into jail, getting taken out of jail is not supernatural. People, you know, unlikely candidates becoming the head of state, it happens, right? We've seen that happen. It's not supernatural. So Yosef had this feeling that his whole life story deserved a bracha, but there wasn't any specific event for the bracha to be chal on, except for one. When he was sitting in the bar, and the snakes and scorpions basically gathered around him and said, "Hi, Yosef," and didn't bite, that was a real divine l'malo min hateva intervention, that Hashem basically went and defanged the snakes and scorpions. So Yosef wanted to make a bracha. He could only make the bracha if he goes back to the bar. But the bracha wasn't really for the bar. What he saw as the miracle of his life was not so much that he was taken out of the bar. I mean, big deal. He was taken out of the bar to be sold into slavery. What was really miraculous was how that whole chain of events wound up putting him into the position where he is now and all the things that he's been able to accomplish. It's really the Hashgacha Pratis, the al pi teva but remarkable events. That's what he really had a cheshek to make a bracha for. That's what he was really feeling overwhelmed by. But you needed something specific to make the bracha bichal on, so he went and it was heitzitz babar.
What's Rashi's point? Which is better?
We'll come.
Water or
we'll come.
Which is more dangerous?
I get in the chasm by Krav, I think I'm probably more dangerous. I'm not sure. I don't know.
So that's what he's saying.
I'm not sure which is more dangerous. I'll come back to that Rashi in a moment. So this is Rav Tanchuma in the Medrash, that when he said in the Medrash that Yosef went Hatzitz Babar, Ulashem Shemayim Neskavein, it was the idea that you could have a whole extraordinary course of events with major historic ramifications, and it's all obviously the Yad Hashem, but it's missing the supernatural event. So you need a supernatural event almost like Yotzeh Tzu Zayin so that you have something to make a bracha on. So the, now, coming, this is Rav Tanchum in the Medrash. There's the same Rav Tanchum in the Gemara that says, Mayimim by Abba Nechash and Makrab Meishpai, who's coming to emphasize to us that bar had, there was something supernatural, right? Even though there wasn't water, but there was Nechash and Makrab, and Yosef was saved from the bar, there was a Lamalam and a Tavanes. This is in the middle of the Chanukah story, in the middle of the Chanukah Sugya. Zok the Meshach Chachma, because that's what we're really doing by Chanukah also. We make a Baruch HaShas Anisim on the Nes of the Shemen. What was the big deal about the Nes of the Shemen? So they were able, if Hashem hadn't made that Nes, so they wouldn't have lit the menorah for those few days.
They could have used
Or they could have used tummy oil, but even let's say worst case scenario, they wouldn't have lit the menorah. So that wouldn't have changed history in any way. So they wouldn't have lit the menorah. They would tummy, they'd be putter. When they would get more oil, they would light the menorah. Life would go on. The really important thing that happened there was that the Chashmonaim had came, and they were Gezel Ashkicham Teresechel Ha'avir Mechukir Tzenacha, and Hashem made a nays to be Meister, the Rabbi Miyad Miyatim, Tmei Miyat Ha'im, Rishon Miyat Tzedikim, and the Chashmonaim were able to defeat them. That was the historically significant event. But that could be misattributed. Yeah, you know, sometimes the underdog wins. So Hashem made the nace of the Shemen, of one day's worth of oil burning for 8 days. The purpose of it was just so that they should be something, so to speak, to be chal on, to recognize that there's something really extraordinary happening here, that it's all a nace and that we should be making a bracha on it. So it's the Shas Nisim, the bracha, the Meisa Mitzvah that we do it on the nace of the Shemen, but the really significant part is the victory over the Yevanim, just as Yosef has Barak Ein by Mayim, that was his Maisenes. But what was really significant was the way he became the Mishnah Malkum, was able to orchestrate events from there. But the Maisa of the Barak Ein by Mayim, the Choshem Akrab Meishpai, was just the specific Lamal Manateva event that was there to open his eyes and recognize that the whole story of his life was really Lamal Manateva. There is not. There is none.
There was a decree.
That's true.
To kill the Jews.
But I'm confused. You said, sorry.
But what we're saying by Hanukkah is that the purpose of the Nes of the Shemen was so that we should recognize that the rest of it was really L'mal Manateva. Now, by Purim, the truth, you know, we're prone to make the same mistake, we're liable to make the same mistake, and there isn't anything to correct us. Over there, it's a different stage of history, and at that point, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was really just trusting us to figure it out for ourselves. There was much more of a Hester Panim at that time, even though it was earlier. But that Nes was done with more of a Hester Panim. But by the Nes of Chanukah, Hashem sent the Nes of the Shemen to help us recognize that this was all a Nes. But the Meshech Chochma's point is that we should recognize the relationship between the two Nisim. The really significant part is the Nitzachain. The Nes of the Shemen is just for us to recognize that. And the Habarik Ein Beimayim, Nechashem HaKrabim Yeshbay, it correlates to that. Al-Pi, this Medrash Rav Tanchuma says in the Medrash Rabbah. Okay.
Where does the Medrash know this?
Where is what?
That Yosef went back to the bar.
Where does who know this one? I'm sorry.
The Medrash.
It's a good question. It's a very broad question. When the Midrashim tell us, Midrashim often tell us things about the story that aren't there in the Chumash.
They come to teach us something.
Yeah, is it meant as history? Did they have a Messiah on it? Is it meant as something different? That's a broader question. Okay. So that's the Parsha Shavuot part. We're going to go to something in the Gavid last Shabbos, but B'li Neder, it's going to come back to Chanukah at the end also. there's a pasuk that we learned this past parasha, this past Shabbos, which I find really one of the most interesting psukim in Tanakh. I say in Tanakh because it's not a pasuk in Chumash. I'm referring to a pasuk in the Haftarah. The Haftarah that we read this past Shabbos, Hayishlach, was from the Nevuah of Ovadia. And the Ovadia is being misnabe about the Geula ba'achas hayamim, about how HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to save Bnei Yisrael, Kibbutz Goliath, a defeat of Esav and the Umos Ha'olam. And in the I think it's the second to last pasuk, when he's describing in particular the Kibbutz Goliath, that the Yidden are going to come from their far-flung Golos and they're going to be brought back to the Arei HaNegev, right, to the cities of Eretz Yisrael. So the description over there of the far-flung Goliath mention it, the pasuk says like this: "V'golos achel hazeh asher mekananim ad tzarfas, v'golos Yerushalayim ad Svarad." So the pasuk mentions two places that we recognize, at least from the contemporary map, as being countries in Europe. Tzarfas, at least nowadays, is thought of as being France.
But there are other locations too, right? In the pasuk,
what?
And after there's a few more locations, no?
In that pasuk?
Yeah.
That pasuk, I don't think so. The surface and Svarad, not Ashkenaz. It doesn't mention Ashkenaz, but surface and Svarad. And nowadays, surface is identified with France, Svarad is identified with Spain, which would make this a very remarkable nevuah. You know, even, you know, nowadays, and I would say for the last, let's say, more than 1,000 years, we've thought of Klal Yisrael as being more or less divided into two groups, even though really this is an oversimplification. There's really many more than two groups. But if you were to make the categories as broad as possible, there are two groups. We'd call them the Svaradim and the Ashkenazim. Now, we use the term Ashkenazim to refer to those Yidden that come from Northern Europe, but the original Yishuv of that was, you know, northern, central, and western Europe, which is France and Germany, roughly. Ashkenaz refers to Germany, Tzarfas refers to France. Among the Gedolei Ashkenaz, all the Balei HaTosfos and Rashi lived in France. So we Ashkenazim, right, we who identify as Ashkenazim, I'm sorry, Aaron, I didn't mean to, you know, I just meant we who, you know, Adrava, you know, we're a nice mix here. But Ashkenazim, That's the label that stuck, but it could just as easily have become Tzarfasim. These are really the two groups that Klal Yisrael has fallen into, Bereis Hayamim, and it seems to be referred to in this pasuk. Now, it isn't necessarily muchach that that's what the pasuk means. Again, it's hard to know for sure what, in the times of the Nevi'im, what they meant when they used these terms. You can't really bring a raya from the fact that nowadays we call France Tzarfas, that's what Ovadia meant when he referred to Tzarfas. And in all fairness, there is another place in Navi that there's a reference to Tzarfas, and it seems to be a city closer to Eretz Yisrael. In Malachim, it refers to Tzarfas that's near Tzidon, which is a little bit north of Eretz Yisrael. But maybe it's related to Tzvas, maybe, because it's almost the same word. But Rashi on the Pasuk says that it's interesting, the way he phrases it is Shamati min ha-paisrim. I heard from the interpreters, as if to say, this is not really my department, you know, I'm not a geographer, but those that are experts at this thing, they tell me that it's France. Rashi lived in France. Rashi says that the pshat that he's heard and he seems to accept is that Tzarfas and the pasuk refers to France. The other Rishonim they have in the Mekoros Gedolei Chumash, I think the Ibn Ezra, I think, also says that Tzarfas refers to France. Svarad, referring to Spain, that Masori goes much, much further back even than Rashi. The Targum Yonis and Menuziel says that the word Svarad over there means Aspamia, which, again, there also you might say it's hard to know for sure what it means, you know, what Yonis and Menuziel meant in his time, but the word certainly is very similar to Spain, Aspamia.
Spain's actually called Espana.
Espana in Spanish.
Yeah.
Okay. So it seems quite likely that that's a reference to Spain, in which would mean that this pasuk in Ovadia is, and he's describing the Kibbutz Goliath, Ba'achres Hayamim.
What
what's the Nevuah saying? What's he saying? What's going
to
happen?
That the Yidden and the far-flung Golias will be brought back to Eretz Yisrael.
Only in those two periods.
Well, that's his way of describing the most far-flung places. And he describes them as Yidden that are Svardim and Yidden that are Tsarfasim, right? The European slash Ashkenazim. So this pasuk is the most direct reference that you have in Tanakh to the idea of Svardim Ashkenazim. Now, when did this come about? This that we say they didn't fall broadly into two categories, and of course each one really has many, many subcategories, but what do we mean when we refer to these two groups? It really, I would say, goes back to the beginning of the Tekuvos HaRishonim. Let's say go back about 1,000 years, 1000s. At that time, there was a transition in the transmission of Torah. Because up till the 1000s, Torah was really centered in one place. Torah was centered in Bavel. If you go back to, let's, you know, to the times of the Amorayim, that was basically all in Bavel. There was also a little bit in Eretz Yisrael, but by far the majority of Torah activity was in Bavel. The main yeshivas, Resurim, Pamadisa in Bavel. And then after the Amorim, during the Tekuvos HaGaonim, it really remained like that. But during the Tekuvos HaGaonim, let's say between the years 500 and 1000, roughly, you had what were originally considered out-of-town communities in faraway places that were gradually growing and becoming stronger. So, and eventually, and these were, we'll come shortly to some more details about how they came about, but let's say Svard and Ashkenaz were these two fledgling communities, and then they were gradually getting stronger and more prominent and more self-sufficient. And then in the year 1038, there was a turning point. Why? Because the year 1038 is the year that Rav Haigun was Nifter. Rav Haigun was the Rosh Hashiva from Padisa. Now, when he was Nifter, nothing really changed. Pampadisa continued as a yeshiva, and he was replaced by somebody else who became the new head of the yeshiva Pampadisa. But what changed was that you had these yeshivas in other places that had been growing in prominence. But as long as Rav Haigun was alive, he was the last of the Ga'inim who was universally recognized as a Gadol B'Torah. So even though there were Yidden and Svard and there were Yidden and Ashkenaz, but everybody knew if there was a major, major Shaila, it had one address. They had to send it to Bavel. And that's the way things had been for the last 1,000 years, or even more than that. For 1,000 years, at least, the center of the Torah world was Bavel. By the 1000s, 1900s, it was already, you know, there were other contestants for that title, but as long as Rav Haigun had lived for a long time, and as long as he was alive, it was still the case that the center of the Torah world, the final authority on any major questions, was in Bavel. He died. He was replaced by a new Rosh Yeshiva, who was no doubt a great Talmud Chacham. But at that point, the Yidden Svarad said, okay, there's a nice yeshiva there with a big Talmud Chacham. We have yeshivas also with big Talmud Chachamim. And in Ashkenaz is the same thing. We have yeshivas here with big Talmud Chachamim. At that point, there was no longer any reason to send big Shailas to Bavel. So then Svarad and Ashkenaz were no longer satellites of Bavel, but were considered each one their own independent community. And so that year is looked at as the transition from the Tekuvos HaGaonim to the Tekuvos HaRishonim. And then there's really two independent centers of the Torah, one in Svard and one in Ashkenaz, like the Nevuah of Avadia seems to refer to. Now, these two, why do I consider them separate? Of course, there were more than two yeshivas. With it, right, there was a yeshiva at that time in Cordoba in Spain, and there was also a yeshiva in Al-Kirwan, right, which is very close to Spain in North Africa. But that's all largely one group. There was a yeshiva in Mainz and there in Germany, and there were, I don't know if it was already, but within a few years there was going to be another yeshiva in Vermeiza. But that's also all considered one, because the real dividing line between these two is that there were really two authorities in the world at that time. There was the Christian world and there was the Muslim world. And each one held a very strong grip over its territory, but they were mutually exclusive. There was almost zero communication or transportation from one to the other. So you had Yidden that were living among the Muslims, you had Yidden that were living among the Christians, But the two had almost no contact with one another. And that's where this divide comes from. Svardim Ashkenazim really means those Yidden that in the 1000s were living under the Muslims, that's what today is called Svardim. And those Yidden that in the 1000s were living under the Christians, that's what today is called Ashkenazim. And because those two communities were so cut off from each other, those two worlds were so cut off from each other, so the Jews of those two worlds grew up very much separated from each other culturally and in their Harbat Satera, right? Halachically, Minhagim, language. You know, in the 1000s, the main Gedolei Adar were Rashi and the Rif, Rashi by the Ashkenazim, the Rif by the Svardim. The two of them were both world famous, but the two of them never heard of each other. And nobody living at that time heard of both of them. You had all the Yidden of Ashkenaz were familiar with Rashi, and that was over a pretty large geographic area. You had all the Yidden of Svard, which was a much larger geographic area. They were familiar with the Rif. The Rif and the Rashi didn't live so far apart from each other. Spain and France are neighbors, but they never heard of each other. And the Yidden that lived in those two places were more or less unfamiliar with one another because one was in the Christian world, one was in the Muslim world. So that's really what we mean when we say that there's these two groups. It's because the Christians and the Muslims divided up the world, and basically with that they divided up the Jews, and that's how the Jews wound up in these two separate groups. Now each one in these two groups has their origin stories, right? By the year 1038, which is where we say it's the beginning of a new Tekufa, and there's and these are the two centers of the Torah world, Ashkenaz and Svard. But obviously that's not, they weren't born yet the day before. They had, been growing for some time. Each one has very interesting origin stories. In Ashkenaz, there's two stories really. One that's a legend, and may or may not be true, but it's probably not so significant. But one that's, I think, more real history. The legend is that way, way back in the times of Churban Bayis Rishon, Nebuchadnezzar took some of the Goylim of Yerushalayim and sent them up north to Germany, and they settled in what later became Vermeise, which is nowadays Worms, Germany. Now, it is true that Worms is one of the most ancient settlements of northern Europe, but this Mesira is as far as I know, it first appears in writing in the 1500s. Over there it says that the Yidden of Worms have this tradition that they were brought there. It's actually a negative tradition. The way the story goes is that they were sent there by Nebuchadnezzar, and then they got word 70 years later that the Yidden were rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash in Eretz Yisrael, and they said, no, thank you, we're very comfortable here. And then when they were wiped out in the Gezeiras Tatnu, that was seen as an einish for that misbehavior some 13 centuries earlier. That's the mice as it's brought down. And as far as I know, there isn't any real record. Certainly there's no record of Yidden in Ashkenaz through all of those centuries. The origin as far as recorded history is concerned is that there was, in the 800s, the kings of northern Europe, if you think back to the world history you learned in high school, so the major king in that time was called Charlemagne, right? Or Charles the Great. And he was basically the king of the whole area that's called Ashkenaz, including France and Germany. And the Ashkenazi Yidden have a Mesira that HaMelech Karl, King Charles, now that might mean Charlemagne, it might mean one of his descendants, because the whole dynasty was called Charles. There was a Charles the Fat, and yes, they called him that to his face. That was his honorary name. And there was a Charles the Bald, and that was considered a Mechubadik name. But one of these kings, Charles, actually made a business deal he sent a message to a king in Italy that, he wanted to make a trade in the resources. I heard you have a resource over there called Jews. And I heard that it's good to have Jews. They're good for the economy. I want to import some Jews. So they made some trade, and it's not recorded what he sent in exchange, but he sent, whatever, timber or wool, whatever. I'll ship you a shipment of this, and you ship me a shipment of Jews. And the king in Italy sent a very mechubadik mishpacha, including big talmidei chachamim. It was called the Kleinimus mishpacha. The patriarch was a Reb Kleinimus, and a lot of the people in the family were named Reb Kleinimus. And they were sent north, and they were settled in Mainz. And this was in the early 800s, and this was the first kehillah of Ashkenaz. And then Vayifru Vayishutzu Vayibru Vayatsma Ma'id Ma'id. And within, let's say, 200 years, they had settled many, many, you know, more Yidden came, and of course, you know, and they grew, and soon you had a whole Ashkenaz. You had many cities in Germany and in France, right? Rashi was from France. That was like a little, you know, that was a little bit further west than the original settlement. It was sort of like an out of town, but eventually that also became very prominent, and soon the whole Northern Europe, including England also, had many, many Jewish communities. They originated from this import that HaMelech Karl made from the Jews of Italy. So that's the origin of the Yidden and Ashkenaz, which means that it's of much more recent origin. They really only started in the 800s. Before that, there was at least as far as recorded history, there was no Yiddishkeit in Northern Europe. Which means it's interesting that at the, you know, when we talk about the 1000s being the time that it's sort of shtelda vek, that there's Sfarzim and there's Ashkenazim, the Ashkenazim were not 50% of world Jewry, they were probably more like 2%. It was a much, much smaller group. Now, Svard is the Yidden that were living under the Muslims, but in particular, we associate Svard with Spain. So when did Yidden start to come to Spain? So here, again, the recorded history, which seems...
But Spain didn't go Muslim until later.
Right? No, at this time it was Muslim. It became Muslim in the 700s.
Spain was already...
Almost the whole Spain. During when the Muslims were doing their big expansion and conquering the world, they conquered the whole Middle East and the whole northern part of Africa, and they went into Spain. That all happened in the 700s. I think around the year 750 they conquered Spain. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it's a little bit confusing because much later, Spain became Christian, right? When we think of the Spanish Inquisition, that's a more familiar part of history. That's Christian. But at the beginning of the Tekuvos HaRishonim, Spain was Muslim.
Under who?
The caliph in Spain was called Al-Rahman, I think. It was the Al-Rahman dynasty. They started coming in the 700s, but there's a Gemara, very interesting Gemara, in Yevamos Daf Kuftes Vav. The Gemara, the end of Masechet Yevamos, the sugyas over there are all about a ish shalach bala, a woman whose husband disappears, and then, you know, we're trying to find evidence that he died, and the discussion of the Gemara about what evidence is considered sufficient to be matir and ishish ish. And among the many stories that it tells over there, Kuftes Vav Amid, the Gemara tells a story about someone called Yitzchak Reish Galusa, who died on the road between Aspamia and Kurtava. Now, what does that mean? So when you learn the Gemara, just simply, my inclination would probably be to say that Aspamia, even though we said before, Aspamia sounds like Spain, but it's got to be a coincidence. Meaning that it must be some other place, but because... The Yidden, this is the times of the Talmud Rabbah, actually Rav and Abaye discussed that case. So it is in the times of Rav and Abaye, it's in the 300s of the Common Era. Spain is more than 3,000 miles away from Bavel. The idea that there could be Yidden in Spain over there seems kind of far-fetched.
Cordoba is in Spain.
But the problem is, right, but the other city mentioned over there in the Gemara is Cordoba. It says a spine of Cordoba, and Cordoba is one of the oldest cities in Spain. So it means it already seems like almost too much of a coincidence to say that it doesn't mean Spain, even though it seems unlikely that there'd be it over there. Somebody showed me recently that there's a Maseirah from Rav Shmuel HaNagid. Rav Shmuel HaNagid was the leader of the Jews in Spain in the 1000s. And he writes that we Yidden, the context over there was that the Goyim and Babel were criticizing the Yidden in Spain for something, and he was sticking up for his constituents and saying, no, don't make fun of us Yidden in Spain, because we have a very old, you know, connection to Torah, because, you know, even though Torah was centered in Bavel, but our connection with the Torah of Bavel goes back to the trip of Rabbi Yitzchak Reish Galusa, who died between Aspamia v'kortava, as is recorded in the Gemara at the end of Yevamos. So he writes Lahedya that this Gemara is a reference to the Yidden in Spain, which would set their history a good 400 years earlier than is generally thought. Because, you know, it's generally thought that they came with the Muslims in the 700s, as the Muslims were expanding outward from Iraq, and then they were traveling along with them. But according to this, there was a community there that was learning Torah from the times of Abaye of Arava. So that's a very extraordinary marmok on this Rav Shmuel Hanagid. But at any rate, they certainly were not producing a daily Torah at that time. They were definitely a much more backward community in terms of Limud HaTorah. There's another important story which talks about the transition, what really catapulted them to the top. And that was the Maisa of the Arba Shvuyim, of the four captives, a well-known story that's recorded by the Ravid in the Seder HaKabbalah. He writes that there was a pirate that captured a ship that had four great Talmidei Chachamim that were traveling, that seemed to have had some shaykhis to the yeshivas in Bavel, but they were traveling from Italy. And he captured them and he sold them as slaves, and he sold them in four different cities. And the Ravid in the Seder HaKabbalah is emphasizing that this was an incredible piece of Hashgacha Pratis, that through this, Torah was spread to more parts of the world, so that when Bavel started to have its decline, there were other communities that were able to step up. But he particularly goes into the history of one of the four captives whose name was Rav Moshe ben Chanoich, and he was a Gadol B'Torah who learned in the yeshivas in Bavel, and he was ransomed in Cordoba. And he tells the story, the rabbi tells the story with some detail. He was ransomed and he was a pigeon shvuyim. There was a yid on a pirate ship. So of course they pitched in, they gave some money to ransom him, but they didn't know that he was anything special. And he was a shamish and sitting in the back of the Beis Medrash. And there was a rabbi who was giving a shir. And the detail is so exquisite. The Ravid brings down Mamash, the sugya that he was giving shir on. He was teaching them about the avoid of the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur. His name was Rav Nosson Hadayin. And this story illustrates the level of scholarship in Spain at that time. Rav Nosson Hadayin was giving shir, and he told the Talmidim that it says in the Talmud, Al Kol Hazot Tfilah. So that means that when the Kohen Gadol was being mazed, there was sprinkling the dam, achas lamal v'shev lamata, for every one of those seven hazois, he would go to the mikveh first, because it says in the Gemara, al kol hazot, or at least it says in the Sefri, al kol hazot tvila. So this Moshe ben Chanoich is sitting in the back of the Beis Medrash, and he raises his hand, and he says, im keim pashuluhu tvilais, meaning to say that it says in the Mishnah that the Kohen Gadol tovled five times on Yom Kippur. But so you just said, so that's eight right there. And that's, for the Dama Par, and again for the Dama Sayer, and Lefnim, and Mechus, and all together, you count them up, there's 43 Hazois. I'll call Hazot Tfila, that's 43 extra Hazois. The Mishnah says there were five Hazois. So this Rav Nosson Hadayin said, ooh, that's a good Kasha. Wow, I didn't know you can ask such a good Kasha. I guess you learned Mishnayos. And then this Rav Moshe ben Chanoich went on to say, I'll tell you the pshat. Al kol hazot tfila doesn't mean going to the mikvah. It means dipping his finger into the blood. He had a kli with the blood. And the Sefri means to be saying that he shouldn't dip in once and then keep on throwing the blood to the mizbeach as long as there's blood on his finger. Al kol hazot tfila. He has to dip his finger separately. Mm-hmm. And then he tells an incredible story. So this Rav Nosson Hadayin says, wait, so you're a bigger Talmud Chacham than I am. He took the turban off of his head, and he put it onto the head of Moshe ben Chanoich, and he said, and he announced to everybody there that from now on, don't call me the Dayan, call him the Dayan. Don't give me the salary as the rabbi, give him the salary as the rabbi. Say, I have a company car, right? Don't give me the chariot that you give to the rabbi, give him the chariot that you give to the rabbi. Rav Moshe ben Chanoich became the Rav of Cordoba at that time, and he made a yeshiva, and he was able to bring the levels of scholarship that they had in Bavel to Spain, and then within a generation or two, Spain was able to be a world-class Makom Torah, thanks to the pirate who brought Rav Moshe ben Chanoich. By the way, the pirate This is the rabbi writes this also. The pirate then tainted it to Mekhtos. The pirate said, I want him back on the boat. They bought him off me for a wife for 5,000, whatever they were, you know, Maravadis. I wanted 100,000. So they went to the king, Al-Rahman. And Al-Rahman said that, no, he should stay because he saw that it was good for the economy that there should be a world-class Makom Torah over there because that way the Yidden don't have to send their shilas to Bavel. Every time they would send shilas to Bavel, they would be, you know, they would want to support the yeshiva. They would send donations to Bavel. Now, Adarabba, donations will be coming in here. Talmidim will be coming here. It'll increase economic activity. So he liked the idea that there was a big Talmud Chacham in Cordoba. So the caliph sided with the Jews over the pirates, and that's how Spain became a world class Makom Torah. So Al Kapanim. So this you have at the beginning of the Tuvos HaRishonim. You have Spain, you have Germany, France, right? France, Germany. This is the Svarad and Tzarfas that Avadya talks about. Now, fast forward 500 years, we have the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch has, of course, the Mechaber and the Ramah. And this also, you know, and this is the divide between the Svarad and the Ashkenazim. Nowadays, all the places where there's Chilukim and Hagim between the Svarad and the Ashkenazim, I shouldn't say all the places, but you know, a good part of it is because the halachas on the Shulchan Aruch that the Mechaber, the Beis Yosef, passes one way, the Ramah passes the other way, and the Svarad and the Minig is to follow the Beis Yosef, which is the Mechaber of the Shulchan Aruch, and the Minig of Ashkenaz was to follow the Ramah. The Beis Yosef was in Tzfas, he came originally from Spain, he was 4 years old at the time of the expulsion, and the Ramah was from Poland in Krakow. Now, there's an interesting story to that also. The Ramah writes in his Akdama that he was working on a Sefer, which was supposed to be a major commentary on the Torah. For every halacha in the Torah, he was going to bring all the background and tell you, you know, bring down the Gemara and the discussions of the Rishonim on the Sugya. And he writes that he had composed his Sefer on the whole Erech Chaim, and he was in the middle of Yerideya, or he was starting Yerideya. And then the Sefer Beis Yosef came out, and it appeared in you know, even in Poland, and you know, he bought it and he looked through it, and he saw that Mamash, this person wrote the Sefer that he was going to write. The Beis Yosef Cairo from Tzfas wrote an incredible commentary on the Torah that compiles all of the background information for all the halachas in the Torah, which is exactly what he was working on. And his initial reaction was, okay, so I'm just going to drop the project. There's nothing left to be done. And then he says, but then afterwards I realized that there's still a need for something. His Sefer is great, but it's not perfect. And that's because the Beis Yosef said that whenever he has a Machlekes Rishonim, so his plan A is to look at the Shlesha Amudi HaHaira, the three pillars of Haira, the three most prominent Poskim from the Rishonim, and he identifies them as the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh. And whenever all three of them speak on a subject, I'm going to take a vote between those three. And if two out of three are on one side, that's the way that I'm going to paskin. Now, the Ramah says it sounds like a great idea. These are three, you know, tremendous paiskim, no doubt about it. You have two out of three of that. Okay, fine. The problem is that the vote is weighted because two out of the three was Sfaradim and one was Ashkenazi. And we have different Messiris and Psak. And among Ashkenazim, the most important influence on Psak is really the Baalei HaTosfos. The Baalei HaTosfos work through the sugyas. Even the Tosfos is not really a halacha sefer per se, but the Tosfos gets involved in all the contradictions between sugyas and figures out how to work out the stiris, and then that leads to certain halacha conclusions, which is primarily what the Rush is doing. The Rush's sefer is primarily working out the halacha al pi the Baalei HaTosfos. So generally, the Rambam, who was very much influenced by the Rif, he was a Talmud of the Talmidei HaRif, he's bringing you the halacha according to the Rif, the Rosh is bringing the halacha according to the Baalei HaTosfos, and every time they're in a machlekes, the Shulchan Aruch passes like the Rambam and the Rif, but that basically means he's ignoring the Messiah of the Ashkenazim. So that's where the Rambam says, that's where I see my role, to bring, to sort of adapt the Shulchan Aruch to make it you more user-friendly for Ashkenazim, that it should incorporate the Maseira in Halacha of Ashkenazim, which is really the work of the Baalei HaTosfos. And those are the Hagois of the Ramah on the Shulchan Aruch. Now, ironically, the Ramah had a contemporary in Poland, some lived at the same time as him in Poland, that was the Marshal. The three of them, all the Beis Yosef, the Ramah, and the Marshal, they all lived at the same time. The Ramah was the youngest of the three, but they all overlap. The Marshal also tells a similar story. He was writing a halacha sefer. It's a very different style, but a halacha sefer called Yamshal Shleimai. And he also writes that while he was doing his, he was working on his project, and then Rav Yosef Kairos Svarim hit the market. And it really, you know, he was a real international sensation. Everybody went and bought it and looked at it. And the Marshal writes that he also initially, he said, you know, he's such a thorough halacha sefer. Well, what's left for me to do? And then he writes something similar but different to the Ramah. He also says, but I decided that, no, there's still a need for my sefer because I'm going to give more weight to the Balei HaTosfos. That's like the Ramah. But he says it for a very different reason. The Ramah basically was saying that, you know, it makes sense that Svaradim should follow the Svaradim, Svaradim should follow the Ashkenazim should follow the Ashkenazim should follow the Ashkenazim. So therefore, the Shulchan Aruch, the Beis Yosef, it's a great sefer, but we need some adjustments to make it work for us. The Marshal makes fun of that whole approach. He refers to it as Achashverosh's approach. Everybody should have it in their own language. The Svaradim should do that, the Svaradim say, and the Ashkenazim should. No, you know, everybody should be interested in one thing. What's the right pshat? What's the right halacha? And it shouldn't matter whether it's the Svaradim Shapaitzim or the Ashkenazim Shapaitzim. We have to figure out who got the sugya right. But then he says, but I happen to think that 9 times out of 10, the Ashkenazim got the sugya right. Because he said the Balei HaTosfos, the Marshal talking, he said the Balei HaTosfos were greater than the Rambam. He says the Rambam is the biggest influence on Svaradish Psak, the Balei HaTosfos is the biggest influence on Ashkenazi Psak, and the Marshal, no, I wouldn't say it, I'm just quoting the Marshal. The Marshal says that the Rambam, with all due respect, was overrated. He says he was great, but he was overrated. The Balei HaTosfos was much bigger. He just goes on about the Balei HaTosfos. Now, not everybody sees it that way. The Beis Yosef definitely did not see it that way. The Beis Yosef considered the Rambam to be the greatest of all the Paiskim. But the Marshal says that because the Balei HaTosfos were better, that's why, that's how he sees the flaw in the Shulchan Aruch's work. So the Marshal and the Ramah, they both saw the same flaw and came to fix it, which is that they wanted a sefer of halacha that's more reflective of the Messiah of the Ashkenazim. But the Ramah's reason was because we're Ashkenazim. And the Marshal's reason was because the Ashkenazim were more correct. Be that as it may, we have Lamais and the Shulchan Aruch, we have the Mechaber, we have the Ramah, and...
He writes it in the Akdama, the Marshal?
Yeah, the Marshal and the Akdama, the Yamshul Shlomo.
If Ashkenazim are an offshoot of Sephardim, because they got transported and then
They got transported from Italy, which was a little bit of a independent community, because Italy was Christian. It's a little... It's sort of a story to itself. They were... And also it was transported very early, in the 800s. So, and after that, they developed completely independently of of the Svaradim.
I have a rabbi who I davened for the past 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
He always says, the Svaradim always had it right.
Okay.
He always got it right.
Okay.
Against the Marshal.
So now, bringing it to the, right, to the 20th century, 21st century, we know there are many, many areas of halacha where Svaradim and Ashkenazim have different minhagim. Svaradim are following the Mechaber, the Ashkenazim are following the Ramah, and now we could just trace that a little bit further back. The Svaradim are following the Mechaber, who's basically influenced by the Rambam, and the Ashkenazim are following the Ramah, who are basically influenced by the Balei HaTosfos. Now, there's one major, major exception to this pattern, and that is in Hilchas Chanukah. In Chanukah, there's a major divide between the way Svaradim light in their Chanukah and the way Ashkenazim light in their Chanukah. And this is, you know, Arye Mezeh, very, very widespread custom by all Ashkenazim. If you have a household with multiple members of the family, so generally everybody lights their own Ner Chanukah. If you have 5 people in the family, so there'll be 5 sets of Neiris in the window. By Svaradim, that's not the minig. By Svaradim, there's 1 set of Neiris for the whole family. What it comes from is the lashon of the Gemara. The Gemara brings the brisa. Mitzvah ner Chanukah ner shubeisai. That the ikar mitzvah is that just 1 ner for a whole household. That's all you need to be yaitzei. But we do a hiddur. Hamahadrin madlikim ner l'chol echad ve'echad. There's a hiddur to light a ner for every member of the family. And then the brisa says v'hamahadrin mina mahadrin should be madlik keneged hayamim hayyitzim, should be meister for haylech, right? The Beitzel Hashita, the meister for haylech. So on the first night there's one, on the second night two, and the third night three, till the eighth night we're lighting eight neiris. Tosfos says that if the idea of being meister for haylech is keneged yamim hayyitzim, then on the third night it should look like the third night. On the fourth night it should look like the fourth night. So then that only works if there's one set of neiris. So then people look at your house and there's one neir, there's two neiris, there's three neiris. But if you have, let's say, four people in your family, so on the first night you're lighting four neiris, the second night, eight neiris, the third night, 12 neiris, then 16 neiris. So somebody looking at your window, he's going to see 12 neiris, 16 neiris, what night of Hanukkah is it? It's not the 12th night of Hanukkah. So it's just meaningless. The number in the window is just meaningless, or at the doorway. So you're not being mekayim, the keneged yamim hayotzim, if you're going to be me'adik l'chalachat ve'echad. So Tosfos says that when the Gemara presents these two hidurim, the Mahadran Amalik Ner L'Chalachat Ve'echad, the Mahadran Min Mahadran Amalik Keneged Yom HaYetzim, it really is meant as two different alternatives. You could do L'Chalachat Ve'echad, or you could do Keneged Yom HaYetzim, which is even better, but don't do both. So if you want to do the bigger hidur, the Mahadran Min Mahadran of Keneged Yom HaYetzim, of being Meisef HaHaylech, then it's just one set of neiros. That's what Tosfos says. The Rambam, interestingly, he's made that's the minhag that he sees around him, but the Rambam says it's the wrong pshat in the Gemara. The Rambam says that the being meister for haylech is supposed to be l'chol echad ve'echad. And so he said, the Rambam says, if there's 10 people in the household, there should be 10 neiris on the first night, 20 neiris on the second night, 30 neiris on the third night, until the eighth night, there should be 80 neiris in the window. So that's, the Rambam says that we're meister for haylech while also doing l'chol echad ve'echad. And Tosfos said, no, if you're Moitz of a Haylech, there should just be one set of neiros for the household. And here, in a great anomaly, the Mechaber in Shulchan Aruch brings down the Shita of the Rambam. Oh, I'm sorry, the Shita of Tosfos. The Mechaber in the Shulchan Aruch says that there's just one set of neiros for the whole household. And that's the meaning of the Sfarad. And the Sfarad just have one set of neiros following the Mechaber, like they always do. But that Mechaber is following Tosfos, right, like he never does. And the Ramah says, no, everybody should have their own set, which is Rambam, following the Rambam. And Ashkenazim follow the Ramah, like they always do, but this Ramah is following the Rambam, like he never does. So in Hanukkah, you have a real anomaly, that the minhag of the Svardim is al pi the learning up of the sugya of the Baal HaYad Tosfos, and the minhag of the Ashkenazim is al pi the learning up of the sugya of the Rambam. Now, why this happened is... I don't know for sure, but it probably has something to do with as follows, that the, you know, Tosfos is talking about learning up the sugya, and he's saying that the pshat in the Gemara would be that you're meitzvah for haylech, but not l'chol echad ve'echad, only one for the whole household. But that's because in the sugya has you lighting the neiros outside.
Right.
But the Baal HaYad Tosfos, the Ashkenazim, the Northern Europe, they never let the neiros outside. A combination of, I don't know what the Iker reason was it because of the weather conditions? Certainly it's much colder where the Ashkenazim lived, together with that there was always much greater friction, hostility from the Goyim. The Eva of the Goyim was definitely greater by the Ashkenazim than it was by the Svardim. Obviously not without exception. There were bad times for the Svardim also. They weren't really having good times for the Ashkenazim during the Tikkun Rishayim. But they were.
Ashkenazim always seemed to rub the guy in the wrong way. Maybe that's why.
The Ashkenazim. Yeah, they definitely had it much, much worse during the Tikkun Rishayim. There were pockets of hostility by the Svardim, but the Ashkenazim had it much worse. So it could be the weather. They never lit outside. They lit inside. Now, if you're lighting inside, the whole time that Tosfos had, that people just look and they see a whole bunch of neiros, 15 neiros, they don't know what type of night of Hanukkah it is. That's all if you're lighting by the doorway. If you're lighting by the doorway, you have to light on the Tevach HaSamach HaPesach. So you're squeezing into that Tevach HaSamach HaPesach, all the neiros they have to put, so it's just going to be a big glob of 15 neiros, 20 neiros. But if you could light indoors, so then you know, you could light in different parts of the house. You're just lighting...
Outside.
What?
If you light outside, you can have more...
No, Adaraba, Adaraba. If you're lighting outside in the doorway. No, you can't do it on the front lawn. It has to be with Tevach HaSamach HaPesach. It has to be right by the doorway. The mitzvah of outside is right by the doorway. But once it's inside, and you're doing it outside, I mean, it's inside deliberately, right? Because you're trying to hide it from the Goyim, so it's all the way in the house. It's not in the window either. So then you could have one in the living room, one in the dining room, one in the kitchen. So then everyone could have their own set of neiros. So then there's no reason, it's not going to mess up the hecker that it's the third night of Hanukkah, the fourth night of Hanukkah, the fifth night of Hanukkah. The Svardim don't start talking about lighting inside till much later. It seems that there was, the old minhag continued for much longer by the Svardim of lighting outside. So they were lighting outside, and if they were lighting outside, then in all likelihood they had the problem of the Baalei HaTosfos. The Baalei HaTosfos talk about it just al derech halimud. They weren't talking halacha lemaisa, but the Svardim had this problem halacha lemaisa that if they're lighting outside, then 15 neiros was going to be a meaningless number. So for them, it made more sense to light one set of neiros. So that may be why the minhag of the Svardim was al pi the shita of the Baalei HaTosfos, the one set of neiros. While the minhag of Ashkenazim developed al pi the shita of the Rambam to light multiple sets of neiros, and that's why nowadays we following the Rambam are doing the shita of the Rambam, and the Svardim following the Mechaber are doing the shita of the Baalei HaTosfos.
So it's for the Jews themselves, right? So you think the Jews are depending to know what night it is by looking at somebody's window? Oh, let me see how many candles he's
got. No. Right. No, it's not. I don't think the connection means so that people could use that as their calendar. So but it means that there's a maila. But it means that there's a maila in your mitzvah in that it corresponds to what night of Hanukkah it is. But it only has that maila.
Not for the people to see.
Not for people to learn from it what night of Hanukkah it is, but yes, for people to see that it should look like you're lighting the third night. It should look like you're lighting the fourth night. That's the maila.
That's your own.